Hello, I'm Claudia Coles, the Administrator of the Washington State Department of Agriculture Office of Compliance and Outreach. And I am serving today as your host for the webinar. And I want to let you know that I'm only able to do this through the help and assistance of many others who are working behind the scenes to make these presentations possible. Our team members come from a number of Western states, and without their support and the support of their institutions, this webinar offering would not be possible. A number of the members who are participating besides the Washington State Department of Agriculture is the University of Connecticut, the U.S. Dairy Innovation Center, we have the University of Wyoming, we have the USDA Risk Management Association, the Washington State Dairy Products Commission, and we have Dennis D'Amico, who is one of our speakers from the University of Connecticut, Lori Babcock, who is an owner of an artisan cheese operation, Tyton Farms and Creamery, Washington State University, and I believe I have named everyone. If I missed anyone, I apologize at the very beginning of this webinar. So today's speakers, you will be hearing from Dennis D'Amico, who is the University of Connecticut Assistant Professor of Animal Science, and Lori Babcock, who is the owner-operator of the Tyton Farm and Creamery, which is located in Tyton, Washington. First, let me explain how the participants in the webinar can put questions to our speakers. The process that will follow is to enter any questions into the chat window that you find at the lower left of your screen. Once you've typed in your question and clicked the button to the left to submit, it is conveyed to our background team. These folks organize the questions and feed them to me as the MC to present to the speakers at the appropriate time. We would also encourage that if you are experiencing any difficulties participating in the webinar, whether the audio or some other issue is occurring, you may also let us know through the same chat window. One of our team will work with you to try and address any technical problems. Finally, before we begin the first session of our conference seminar, we would like to point out that if you're having trouble viewing the on-screen slide material, you may click on the full screen button to toggle the slides to fill the entire screen on your machine. Clicking it again will reveal up the chat window and the slide materials in a side-by-side format. So a few questions for the audience. We'll be having a poll showing up on your screen, so please respond to them. The questions are about tell us about yourself, what's your primary occupation, and check any and all that apply. Where is your main place of business located? You'll want to check one only. And which of the following best describes you? So these questions will be popping up onto your screen. The last question will be, including yourself, how many individuals are participating in this webinar from your home office or from your home or from your office? And please check one only. So we give you some time to go through the polls and fill out these questions for our information. Okay, there's one more following question for everyone to fill out, which is, which of the best describes you? Okay, so now we're going to actually move on to our very first speaker, which will be about the Food Safety Modernization Act and its impact on artisan cheesemakers. Our first presenter will be Dennis D'Amico, who is Assistant Professor of Dairy Foods in the Department of Animal Science at the University of Connecticut. Dennis is a founding member of the Vermont Institute for Artisan Cheese, and he's an active member of the American Cheese Society, the American Dairy Science Association, and the Worldwide Trade Cheese Association. Dennis, we'll turn it over to you.
Excellent. Thank you. Hello, everyone, and thank you all for joining this webinar. In the next half hour or so, I'm going to try and provide a general overview of some of the key aspects of the Food Safety Modernization Act, or FSMA, and how it relates to artisan cheesemakers. So the Food Safety Modernization Act was signed into law in 2011 and represents the most significant change to our U.S. food safety law since the 30s. It's changing the focus of our food safety system from one of reaction towards one of prevention. And as many of you have heard or experienced with HACCP, this is going to rely heavily on documentation. So we always say, if you didn't document it, it didn't happen. So I know this all may seem pretty daunting for many of you, but there will be assistance available. I'd like to point out first that FDA will likely explain more of these items more specifically through what are called guidance documents. The link I provided will take you to where there are some current documents you can review just to get an idea of what they'll look like. But they will be coming out, rolling out in the next few years. Also, the FDA has funded what's called the Food Safety Preventive Controls Alliance. This is a combination of scientists, regulators, and producers that have come together to develop the materials and training to assist with producers with FSMA, and this is specifically targeted to small and medium-sized businesses. So that will also should be available to you through your state or extension or some other avenue. So let's look at some of the general elements of the Act. First, under FSMA, facilities must register with the FDA. And new registration every other year between October 1st and December 31st of each even-numbered year. So the last registration was in October 1st of 2012. The next one will be in 2014. So the new registration provides FDA with a list of registered facilities for both inspection purposes and also provides for FDA to suspend registration and thus halt production of food at that facility if needed. When you register, you identify a food category, and now cheese has been divided into four categories, soft ripened cheeses, semi-soft cheeses, hard cheese, and other cheese and cheese products. Now, FDA has expressed a desire to collect fees from registered facilities, but it does not have the legal authority, so there will be no fee to register your facility or for your initial inspections. However, if they do need to come back and do a reinspection or they need to initiate a mandatory recall, there will be charges of $237 per hour for the reinspection or recall of a domestic facility. The good news is that FDA does not intend to issue any invoices until they publish a guidance document with guidelines on how small businesses can request a fee reduction. So if there was any reinspections that have happened so far, they're not planning on issuing any invoices yet. Other new and enhanced enforcement powers that went into effect immediately include mandatory recall authority and expanded access to records. Under FSMA, FDA will have legal access to your food safety plan as well as any related documents, such as environmental and finished product testing. Access also expands to foods that are handled in a similar manner. So if a food safety risk is suspected for one cheese variety, it's likely that they will have access to your food safety plan and records associated with other cheeses manufactured in that facility. It's also important to note that it's a prohibited act to fail to establish and maintain these records, or to fail to make them available to the FDA, which includes making copies for them to take with them when they leave. Other notable changes include an increased rate of inspection of food facilities. For example, a high-risk domestic facility will be inspected within 5 years of the passage of the Act, and then within every 3 years. So if you haven't been inspected yet, there's a very good chance you will leave very soon. Other things to keep in mind is that the FDA is becoming more inspection and enforcement oriented. Inspections can become a little more aggressive and adversarial than in the past. And as I noted before, the focus is shifting to one of document review. So consistency of documentation and having a clear rationale for any decisions you make is going to be critical. Also, FDA is becoming more public. They're posting inspection observations, or what are called Form 483s. These are being posted onto the web. And they're also pursuing injunctions, which allows for the suspension of production and the detainment of products. So as an example, in fiscal year 2013, which closes in October, FDA planned the inspection of 264 cheese facilities with a specific focus on artisanal producers. They've also initiated three domestic assignments. The first two are well underway, and these are the ones that we've affectionately called the Swabathons. FDA was specifically inspecting soft and semi-soft cheese manufacturing facilities, swabbing for the pathogen Listeria monocytogenes. For these two domestic assignments, they were looking at large and small industrial and artisan. So it's more of an industry-wide assignment. The third domestic assignment was began in March of 2013, and this expanded to include the inspection of aged cheese producers. And this includes not only environmental swabbing, but also finished product sampling. And in addition to Listeria monocytogenes, inspectors are looking for E. coli, especially the shigatoxin-producing E. coli, such as 0157H7. There's also been talk that they are targeting companies that have had previous positives. So if you've been inspected in the last couple of years and had a positive result from an environmental sample or a finished product, odds are they are going to be back to visit fairly soon. So perhaps the most important and debated piece of FSMA is the Hazard Analysis and Risk-Based Preventive Controls Rule. This is what we call HARPSE for short. This rule is very similar to HACCP, but instead of HACCP plans, we will have what are called food safety plans, and some people call them HARPSE plans. So slight change in wording. So under this rule, the owner, operator, or agent in charge of your facility must prepare or have prepared and implement a written food safety plan. Now, the food safety plan must also be prepared by, or its preparation overseen by, what's called a qualified individual. And this qualified individual is also tasked with the responsibilities of validating preventive controls, reviewing the records for the implementation and effectiveness of the preventive controls, determining the appropriateness of corrective actions, and reanalyzing the food safety plan as needed, which we'll discuss a little bit coming up. So what is a qualified individual? Well, a qualified individual is defined as someone who has successfully completed training in the development and application of risk-based preventive controls. This can be done through a training that's been recognized as adequate by the FDA and must be documented. But you can also become a qualified individual through job experience that has been effective at teaching someone how to apply a food safety system. Now remember, FDA has funded the Food Safety Preventive Controls Alliance, and they're been tasked with developing this training curriculum. So if you take the this training, you can become a qualified individual. So briefly, the Food Safety Preventive Controls Alliance has also been assigned additional tasks. So in addition to the training materials, they're creating technical assistance network for small to medium facilities, and they're also tasked with developing commodity or industry-specific guidelines for preventive controls, among others. So some of those guidelines I talked about, there should be cheese and small-scale cheese production-specific guidelines for implementing FSMA, and this should be coming out of the Food Safety Preventive Controls Alliance. So for many of you, the contents of this food safety plan will look very familiar to the contents of your HACCP plan. It includes a hazard analysis, preventive controls, the monitoring of those controls, corrective action procedures, verification, and a recall plan. Again, very similar to what we've seen in HACCP before. So just like in HACCP, we're going to be developing product descriptions and flow diagrams for each of our products, and then we're going to identify any known or reasonably foreseeable hazard at each of these steps. And so hazards will include biological, chemical, physical, and now radiological hazards that may be associated with the facility or the food, and also may be naturally occurring or intentionally added. So as producers of ready-to-eat foods, being cheese, we also must identify environmental pathogens, and this is Listeria monocytogenes in the case of dairy. And last, any hazards that are considered reasonably likely to occur must be addressed by a preventive control. So despite this long definition, preventive controls basically include the procedures, practices, and processes that will either significantly minimize or prevent the identified hazard. So again, this is very similar but much broader than what we've seen with the critical control point approach of HACCP. So for example, preventive controls will include what we've traditionally called prerequisite programs. And these include things such as allergen controls, good manufacturing practices, traceability, recall, food defense, training, and cleaning and sanitation, among others. So much broader than a straightforward critical control point. Some of the major preventive controls will include ensuring protection from cross-contamination with allergens. And there's a new wording for that, and it's called cross-contact. This can be done through ensuring protection against cross-contact and also ensuring proper labeling. Sanitation is a control, the prevention of cross-contact with allergens and also the cross-contamination with microorganisms, especially the control of food contact surfaces from Listeriomyces cytogenes and other contaminants where ready-to-eat food is exposed to the environment. And lastly, we have what are called process controls, which includes all the procedures, practices, and processes performed during the manufacture of the food product, such as cooking or cooling or acidification, among others. All preventive controls are going to need to be validated to ensure that they are capable of controlling the hazard. We must also verify or identify parameters that are associated with preventive control and monitor those. And we also have to make sure that the preventive control is verified to make sure it's doing what we expect it to be doing. And so verification activities may include such things as environmental and finished product testing. Now, environmental and finished product testing are not mandatory under the current draft of the rule, and the FDA is seeking comment about this. And then lastly, we need to develop corrective action plans for potential problems. So this should look very similar to critical control points such as pasteurization. So pasteurization has been validated extensively. Monitoring is monitoring of the time temperature. Verification would be testing afterwards. And then corrective actions would be something like a flow diversion and a repasteurization. So fairly straightforward. Now, you're not going to be able to produce a document once and then forget about it. This food safety plan must be evaluated once every 3 years or when there's a significant change that has created the potential for possibly a new hazard, or if there's a change that is significantly increased the concentration or presence of a previously identified hazard. Food safety plans also need to be reevaluated when there's new information about potential hazards associated with the food, and also when a preventive control is not properly implemented, maybe that's ineffective, or we find that we have no established corrective action procedure. So remember, keeping updated is important because the food safety plan and all those related documents must be made available to the FDA during an inspection. So now I just want to talk about one of the more hot topics, and that's what's called qualified facilities. Qualified facilities are businesses that will be exempt from the HARPC requirements that we just discussed and will not have to submit a food safety plan to the FDA. So the first category is called a very small business. And the FDA in the draft has proposed three different categories, which are based on average annual revenues of the previous 3 years. And it could be either less than $250,000, less than $500,000, or less than $1 million. And according to a recent survey conducted by the American Cheese Society, 65% of respondents reported income less than $250,000, and another 17% reported between $250,000 and $1 million. So it's highly probable that a majority of artisan and farmstead producers will actually be exempt under the definition of a very small business. The other definition of a qualified facility comes from what is referred to as the Tester Amendment. Here, again, based on the average of the previous 3 years, would be a total average annual sales of less than $500,000, and at greater than 50% of your sales have to go to what are called qualified end users. A qualified end user can be a consumer located anywhere, or a restaurant or retail food establishment that's in the same state as the farm, or not more than 275 miles away. Now, although you're exempt from some of the HARPC requirements, there are modified requirements for qualified facilities. For example, the owner-operator agent in charge must submit a statement certifying that the facility meets the definition of a qualified facility. You're not required to submit the actual financial information to support it, but you must make that type of information available upon request. Qualified facilities are also required to certify that they have identified the potential hazards, so conducted a hazard analysis, and are implementing and monitoring the performance of preventive controls to address these hazards to ensure they are effective to satisfy the requirement. So again, you're exempt from a lot of the HARPC requirements, but you're still going to have to conduct the hazard analysis, identify preventive controls, implement and monitor those controls. However, there's a second option, and that's to submit documentation that you comply with a local, state, county, or some other non-federal food safety law. So this could be certification by your State Department of Agriculture. So if you choose the former, which I hope you do, your food safety plan should closely resemble HARPC, or what other businesses are doing for HARPC, just to get you in line with other businesses. But this could include a HACCP plan, if you already have one in place, with some minor revisions and additions to make it more closely resemble HACCP or HARPC. If you choose the latter option, which I hope no one does, the only requirements are you have to provide the name and complete business address of your facility where the food was manufactured, and this must be prominent and conspicuous. So on the label of the food, or if it's at the point of purchase, it needs to be on something like a poster or a sign, or if you're selling something over the internet, an electronic notice to accompany it. As a qualified facility, the documentation certifying you're a qualified facility must be submitted to FDA within 90 days of compliance date of the rule, which I'll mention later, and then must be submitted every 2 years or whenever there's a material change to the information. So if you happen to fall out of one of the qualifying categories, you're going to need to resubmit to address that. You, as with everything else, you're going to need to maintain records that are used to support this documentation. So again, if you're a qualified facility based on financials, then you should maintain the records that show those financial qualifications. If you're falling under the Tester Amendment, then you should have the records maintained and available that show the percent of sales to those qualified end users. You also are going to need to have your food safety plan, your operating license, and other documentation that you need to meet those requirements. And again, this needs to be made available to the FDA upon request. Keep in mind, FDA can withdraw your exemption. So if there's an active investigation of a foodborne illness outbreak that's directly linked to a qualified facility, they can withdraw the exemption. And if they feel that it's necessary to protect public health and prevent or mitigate a foodborne illness based on conduct or conditions of a facility. So if they're coming to your facility and you don't have anything in place and you're just abiding by your you're being a qualified facility and exempt from all of these food safety, if they still think that your actions or your facility pose a threat, they can withdraw your exemption, which is why I highly recommend going with the coming up with a food safety plan. So just to reiterate, qualified facilities are exempt from the HARPC requirements, but not the rest of the Act. And part of this includes the good manufacturing practices, which can be found in the same section. So in about 3 years, the old good manufacturing practices, which are located right now in 21 CFR 110, will be replaced by new good manufacturing practices located in 21 CFR 117. If you just type that in to your favorite search engine, it should pop up pretty easily. The language in these documents will be updated. For example, current GMPs use the terms shall and should. Shall is now going to be replaced by the word must, and any items that were recommendations or considered shoulds will be deleted and will become FDA guidance, again, those guidance documents. So just some examples of significant new requirements. It'll include, as you heard before, the control of cross-contact from allergens, protection of food packaging from cross-contamination with microorganisms, installation of equipment to make sure it facilitates its own cleaning and the cleaning of adjacent areas. Just some examples. There's plenty more. Then there's some recommendations that may now be required. So some of these are still up for comment. Some of these recommendations, for example, are the personnel responsible for food safety at your facility must have a background to provide competency to process safe food. Training may become mandatory for employees and supervisors. And the cleaning of non-food contact surfaces may now be required to protect against contamination of food and food contact surfaces. Some other recommendations that may now be required, again, up for comment. These include portable equipment and utensils being stored in a way to prevent contamination of allergens and microorganisms, inspection of shipments and raw materials, and protecting food from contaminants that may drip, drain, or are drawn into food. So again, I advise you to go in and look at the proposed regulations and comment if you haven't done so already. So in conclusion, given the time you have until this rolls out, since the Act was passed, the HARPSE rules were passed in January 16th of this year. The proposed rule went to the Federal Register and was opened up for public comment. They've subsequently pushed the comment period back to November 16th of 2013 right now. So as of today, I believe, the comment period will close on November 16th. So if we do some estimates, that means that we could expect to see the final published rule in around July 1st of 2014, and then we'll have the subsequent rollout based on facility size. So large plants will be in 2015, small plants will be in 2016, and very small plants will be in 2017. So given the amount of time that we have until this rolls out, you should be planning ahead and being proactive. What I would focus on is developing and or revising your food safety plan. So for those of you who are just starting, it may be beneficial to start with a HACCP plan or review your current HACCP plan. I also encourage you to review mandatory HACCP regulations. So FDA has mandatory HACCP for both fish and juice producers. And actually, fish and juice producers will be exempt from FSMA and the HARPSE, or from the HARPSE requirements because of this HACCP program. So a good way to get some insight into what's going to be required is to go to those regulations, which you can find on the FDA website fairly easily. Other things I would focus on, you might need a consultant, again, with this qualified individual setting up your food safety plan. You might need to have a consultant come in early on until some of that training becomes available. And you also, given the increased inspections and the swabathons and everything that's going on, I would focus on setting up an environmental testing monitoring program to get yourself ready for that and also to prepare you for FSMA as it comes out. You're also going to want to work on your supply chain. So this includes shoring up traceability, working on ingredients and making sure ingredients coming in are safe, and then really working on records maintenance and access, including making sure that all your records are inspection ready. So lastly, keep up to date with the regulations as they come out. Keep an eye out for guidance documents as they become available, and you should be able to get this going in time for when it finally gets implemented in a few years from now. So with that, I thank you for the time, and I thank you again for all coming and for everybody who helped put this together. And I believe I'm going to be opening this up for some questions now and then possibly, if not now, at the end when we have a panel discussion after our next speaker. Thank you again.
This is Claudia Coles. I'm your MC for today, so thank you again, Dennis, for the presentation. I'm going to introduce our second speaker, which is Lori Babcock, who is the owner-operator of the Tyotin Farm and Creamery, which is located in Tyotin, Washington. And also, Lori is an advisor to the Washington State Artists and Cheese Festival Group, which will be holding their annual conference here coming up in October, which I'm also going to do a plug because we're going to have a one-day workshop on October 11th in the Seattle, Washington area, and there'll be more information with a link towards the end of this webinar. So with that, Lori, I'm going to turn it over to you.
Hi. Thank you. Thank you for that great introduction, Claudia. I am quite honored and a little overwhelmed to be speaking at this webinar, especially after such a great speaker like Dr. D'Amico. I am just happy to be here, so thanks for having me. I am Lori Babcock, and that's my wife, Ruth, and I. We are the owners of Tyotin Farm and Creamery, located here in the beautiful Yakima Valley in Washington State. Ruth and I both had a lifelong desire to farm and live the so-called simple life. We both came to the realization that we were quite bored with our current careers, and if we were ever going to live our farm dream, we better move on it and do it soon. We had started a tiny urban farm in the Seattle area where our cousin had about an acre and a quarter of seriously overgrown property that was just screaming for goats, and that is where we got our start. For 5 years, we raised organic vegetables and animals, and that is when I fell in love with the cheese-making process that we got from the milk of the goats and the sheep. I blended the milks then since it was all that I had, and I loved the cheese that it made so much that I still blend their milks to this day. We quickly outgrew our 1.25 acres, and now, as you're seeing photos, we have a 21-acre farm where we raise a variety of animals. We are a diverse farm that practices management-intensive grazing, where the animals are rotated through the different pastures, always eating fresh browse. The main events being, of course, the dairy goats and sheep for cheese making. We have poultry for pasture management and pigs who are fed the whey from the cheese production. So as on a sustainable farm, nothing goes to waste. We, being farmer, owner, producers, are very concerned with product safety. And as a farm where we raise our own herd, we believe safety and cleanliness begins in the field. Our animals are free-ranging on fresh pastures that are never sprayed with herbicides or pesticides, and we have no need for chemical fertilizers. Our water is coming from the Rimrock Dam and is beautiful and clean. Our animals are healthy, and we verify that daily when we milk them ourselves. We know the health of each spoiled goat and sheep every day and can immediately remove any suspect animal. Again, as owner-producers, we are really concerned about the quality and safety of the end product, not just because it's the law, but because it reflects directly upon us. We are responsible for each step of the cheese-making process, and we take pride in the end product being the very best we can offer. As our emphasis has always been on prevention, what concerns us with the broader legislation of food-making processes is that we will be given the additional burden of record-keeping. This is a time-consuming job for a small operation like ours. I can see and promote larger operations having the need where, you know, they have many employees and they're probably using transported milk from confined animals. But we have so little, if anything at all, in common with big commercial producers, yet we may be treated with the same exact broad brush. Not that small producers do not have the need to have and maintain high standards for sanitation. I know this is very critical. We just have a very different set of variables. Quality is the priority over quantity in small batch cheese making, and part of that quality is high standards for cleanliness by definition. Making great cheese is always all about the great milk, and great milk comes from healthy animals in a healthy environment. You cannot have a high-quality product without it being a safe product. But you can have a safe product that has absolutely no relationship to quality. And when I have witnessed commercial, let's call it cheese-like products being made, I have to tell you, I would rather eat my cell phone. Prevention versus reaction sounds great, but if the model that the FDA is shooting for is similar to what the USDA already does for meat inspection, then I personally worry that paperwork and making the process the same for all processors will supersede quality. This is not in artisan cheese making interest, and, you know, it's a cheesemaking has a lot of different processes. It can vary from cheesemaker to cheesemaker, and we can all still produce a safe product. Cheesemaking is a wonderful but ancient craft. And today, because of regulated high standards for safety, we all use modern equipment like pasteurizers, pH meters, ball meters, hygrometers, all kinds of meters. Stainless steel everything, swabs for testing, and laboratory testing, all to ensure product safety. I personally would like to see some FDA approval for bringing back some of the ancient methods that can be safe and be allowed, like aging on wood planks, wrapping our cheese in spruce boards, having handmade rush baskets, all tools that impart flavors and nuances to cheese that chemistry from cultures do not. I personally have also never understood why European cheese producers are allowed to use these tools, and we get to compete with those cheeses in the marketplace, but we cannot use the same methodologies. If we can import those products made with using those old world tools, then why can't we use those tools ourselves? I would welcome training as a requirement, however, and I would love to see some microbiology courses offered specifically to cheesemakers. I believe it is important to learn and keep updated on pathogenic control and how pathogens can get into our products. Learning the science behind why we need to prevent them is very, very helpful. For me, Listeria M remains totally mysterious as to how it can exist in the air, on our clothing, on our shoes, and hide in places that are hard to reach and clean, yet more people aren't contracting it daily from their own home kitchens on a fairly regular basis. It seems like it would be on every household sponge. At Hyacinth Farm and Creamery, we have no mechanical equipment outside of that pasteurizer, which of course was designed to be cleaned. Everything else is done by hand. So cleaning is pretty straightforward. To me, record-keeping requirements on that type of prevention just make an already long and hard day longer and even harder. With the FDA getting access to records, it seems to suggest that we need to know a lot about what those records are supposed to look like, and I understand that training is forthcoming, and I hope that's coming soon. In closing, I really wanted to speak to the idea that FDA inspections are to become adversarial and charge us $237 an hour for a re-inspection. And I encourage all of you that are listening to comment at least on this portion of it. First of all, I would like to be able to charge $237 an hour for anything that I do. I'm sure that Dr. D'Amico and all the wonderful staff and people that are putting this webinar together today were paid much more modestly than that for their time. And me, I'm just hoping that someone will buy me a beer at the end of this day. Those kinds of fees will just put small producers out of business. And on top of that, they actually want to be adversarial as well, which I find frightening and honestly insulting to imagine that the great and big, powerful FDA take on the likes of small owner producers like Ruth and I. In the context of the small family farm producing small batches of farmstead cheeses, we could not be more invested in product safety. We are actually risking everything we own. Our personal reputation depends on it, and we would never want anyone to be sick from our products. I believe the FDA should be grateful for our existence, as I am grateful for all the other great farmers I know producing great products from their own farms. Thank you, everyone, for your time.
This is Claudia Coles, Hate Your MC for the day for the webinar. Lori, thank you very much for your words and information about the Tyneton Farm and Creamery. As you can hear in Lori's presentation, I think we have a lot of different perspectives about what the preventive controls rules that FDA is proposing are about, and how people have different perspectives on them and different opinions. So again, part of our presentation that Dennis presented today and information Lori's provided will help you in turn realize why it's very important for everyone to provide draft comments to the Food and Drug Administration and to regulatory organizations such as WYON, the Washington State Department of Agriculture. So now we are actually going to move into our question and answer phase. So we have a number of different questions, and we want to make sure, Dennis, are you on the line also with Lori?
I believe so.
And Lori, do we still have you on the line?
Okay, I think I'm there.
Okay, I have both Dennis and Lori on the line. Great. Okay, so couple different questions that we have here, and Dennis, this is really a question for you probably, and then Lori, you know, you might have a different perspective or similar, or you might want to add on. The question is what is the difference between high-risk and low-risk foods?
High-risk has been identified, it's high-risk facilities, and it's based on the food products that you manufacture. And so there is a definition, and I can try to find the link for people to go to. Essentially, if a food category or product has been linked to a foodborne outbreak, facilities that manufacture that food become high-risk facilities. You can also become a high-risk facility if you manufacture a low-risk food, but your facility has had issues in the past with, say, environmental pathogens or things like that. So there's several ways that you get put into one category or the other, but it's a facility, not the food.
Okay. Lori, did you have anything that you might want to add on to that at all?
Well, I guess, is he saying it that would we be high risk as cheesemakers because we're dealing with milk?
Yeah, so cheesemakers are considered high risk. Spinach producers, anybody that's been involved in an outbreak. So large, small, if you manufacture a food that's been linked to an outbreak, that's a high-risk food.
So the next question that we have that's been asked is, what are the metrics by which FDA may recognize training is adequate to prepare a qualified individual?
As far as I know, the training, the only one I know of that will be recognized by them, and this isn't to say that there aren't others, is the training that's being developed by the Preventive Controls Alliance. I'm not sure about other HACCP courses or things that have other people may have attended in the past. So all I know is that there's been mention. The reason they funded this group is to develop these training materials to inform people how to make these plans. So that's the only one I'm familiar with at this point.
So in other words, this may be a good area where if people have questions about that, to actually, if they're putting comments into FDA on the drug preventive controls, they may want to ask FDA for more clarity on this.
Yeah, find that there should be contact individuals available for questions about the act, and that would be a reasonable question.
Good.
And it might be found in a frequently asked questions section as well.
Lori, I have a question for you. As a small artisan cheesemakers, what types of training do you feel that you and your industry needs in order to help you be successful as an artisan cheesemaker?
Well, that's a really, good question and a very broad one. I think from a food safety point of view, the microbiology and the sanitation are really good classes just even start with. People often say, you know, that they want to be cheesemakers, and the very first thing I like to remind them is if you don't like washing a lot of things all the time, you're not going to like cheese making. As far as the artisan part and getting back to old world cheese making techniques, they're really, I mean, you're maybe more able to speak to this than me, Dr. D'Amico, because you really have to kind of search that stuff out. The classes that I see being offered by WSU, they're really good, but I think they're a higher, more commercial level of teaching and training than what I would sort of want to learn as an artisan cheese making with the hands-on techniques. So I don't have a wealth of information, but I'm sure there are others that do.
Thank you, Laurie. So one of the questions that we have here is, do we anticipate that Tyentin Farm would be a qualified facility?
Well, it depends on how they draw that monetary level, but I do think that, you know, even if we're not qualified right now, we would probably need to participate in all these things soon.
Good. One of the other questions we have from the audience is, and Dennis, this might be a good one for you too, is these exemptions are based on gross income, and the income will include the milk check, you know, so the milk being processed off the farm, hay, maple syrup, vegetables. Are dairy farms getting caught up by being above the income trigger?
The way it's written is that food sales, so the revenue will include food sales of all products grown or raised for human or animal consumption or to be used as ingredients in any of those items. So it's tricky to read that, but the way it sounds is that any food that can be eaten but that's raised on the farm for human or animal consumption will be counted towards the gross revenues.
So again, this is a really good example of an item where, you know, if FDA is seeking input, you know, both our small operation and interested parties might really want to make sure that they're providing comment into FDA, again, either for clarity or if you have a rationale that the FDA should make sure that they're considering. I mean, FDA truly does want to hear from the industry and from consumers out there about the draft rules and getting information to them to help make better clarity on what they have currently in their draft. So I encourage people to submit comments.
Absolutely. That's why they keep pushing it later and later, is because they're trying to encourage more comments.
Right. So one last question I have is probably more for you, Dennis, but is, what is cross-contact versus cross-contamination?
Yeah, so that's just a wording. So we used to say, essentially, it's cross-contact is cross-contamination with an allergen. So it's just an easier, well, I don't know, depending on who you talk to, it's an easier way of differentiating cross-contamination from a microorganism from that of an allergen. So you can just say cross-contact, and everyone will know you're talking about allergens. And if you say cross-contamination, you're only talking about microorganisms.
All right. Thank you. So as we've been asking the questions to our two speakers and getting answers from them, some different polling questions have been appearing on the screen, and so we're hoping that you guys have all been responding to the polling questions. And a couple of the questions that have been were, how aware were you of the issues discussed today, and how would you rate your awareness? Was this webinar worth your time? And what's your greatest take-home point from today's seminar? And what's your likelihood of participating in a future seminar? So again, today's speakers have been Dennis D'Amico with the University of Connecticut, Assistant Professor of Animal Sciences, and Lori Babcock, the owner-operator of the Tyentin Farm Creamery located in Tyentin, Washington. And Dennis and Lori, we thank you very much for your participation today. So a major point that I want to emphasize, because we've had a couple of questions on this, is the webinar will be available at a later date, and you will be able to be having information provided to you coming up in just a moment. We are going to be having both a PDF available for download and a number of resources available to you. On your slide right now, you should be seeing the Food Safety for Farmstead and Artisan Cheesemaker workshop, and that's going to be held in Seattle, Washington on Friday, October 11th, and we welcome everyone to be joining us. We're going to have it available both in English and in Spanish, and we have a link to this workshop, again, on your site, and that will be a link to the information on the PDF download information that is coming out to you. And so the U.S. Dairy Innovation website has a lot more information and on training, and I understand that we will be seeing a link to where you can download all this information in one of the upcoming slides here. So on this slide, again, what area or topic of today's seminar would you like to see covered in future webinars? And if you could, we encourage you to use a Q&A chat section so we can provide information. We would like to hear from you about more topics and presentations that you'd like to see. And here's the slide that talks about where we can get more information. This is where the speaker slide sets and access to the recorded version of the webinar will be at Ag in Uncertain Times website at aginuncertaintimes.farmmanagement.org. So again, that's on your slide currently, aginuncertaintimes.farmmanagement.org. So all the speaker slides will be there, the recorded version of the webinar, and other information that we're providing to you as resources will be available. If you would like to save this information, we have a file share window that's on your screen right now. So click on each file listed below to highlight it, and then click on Save to My Computer. So you should have a screen that just popped up on your computer, and you can upload the files by clicking on Upload File. At this point, I'm seeing that we're getting a lot of great topics and suggestions for future webinars and workshop information. So thank you very much, because you know this is our first beta test of doing one of these webinars. And again, I really want to thank everyone that's been participating. We couldn't be doing this without you. So again, just to kind of emphasize, the Washington State Department of Agriculture, we are actually hosting this webinar due to the fact that we actually had received a USDA risk management grant opportunity. We've been working in conjunction with the U.S. Dairy Innovation Center, with our partners from the Washington State Dairy Products Commission, the University of Connecticut, Washington State University. We actually even also have Montana State University, University of Wyoming, and let's see, I'm just making sure I have all of our partners, the Center for Farm and Financial Management, and of course, all of our speakers, Lori Babcock and Dennis D'Amico today. So again, I'd just like to do one more thank you to all of our participants today in our webinar. We sincerely hope that you find today's content of value in your work. We hope to see you again in one of our upcoming programs. And until then, we offer you our sincerest hope for success in meeting the challenges of today's uncertain times. Again, this is Claudia Coles with the Washington State Department of Agriculture, and I really appreciate your participation today. Thank you very much.